Peter Matheson is known for both his fiction and his nonfiction. He has just completed the third installment in a trilogy that has obsessed him for some 20 years. The final installation in the story of E.J. Watson, it is called Bone by Bone. After getting versions of the mysterious life and death of Edgar Watson from locals and family, we finally get to hear the story straight from the source. I am pleased to have Peter Matheson back at this table to talk about this story. Welcome back.
Hello, Charlie. How are you?
You're not thrilled by the word trilogy, are you, or not?
Well, I originally conceived it as one enormous book.
Yeah.
But I think my publishers were aghast when the manuscript came in at well over...
1,000.
Well over 1,000, 1,500.
Yeah, right. And they said, Peter, no.
Well, they didn't. I made the judgment call ahead of that, and I split it up. But I still think of the book that way.
Might you ever publish it that way?
It's not whether I would publish it. I'm going to make this a thing to do. I'm going to revise it in one book, but whether I'll find a publisher is something else.
So you'll edit it down so that it's...
It'll be shorter. It'll be shorter as reformed into one book.
And what would you call the condensed version?
I think I'd have to find a new title because it would be too confusing. Yeah.
Tell me the story.
The Labyrinth.
The Labyrinth, yeah. The Labyrinth, that would be it. Uh-huh. Well, where are we in the story?
The Everglades are kind of a metaphor of the Labyrinth, you know, and it stands for so much progress of life and so on.
Right.
You mean a rundown
of
the
tell
story?
Tell me where we are.
Well, Mr. Watson was actually a historic figure, and he lived in the Everglades and was killed in the Everglades in 1910 by his neighbors and 33 bullets worth. So they didn't know halfway measures there. You know?
We talked about that last time, but for the viewers who didn't see the last conversation with you.
But he was also very successful, and people liked him. He had three wives and seven children with these wives, and he had a few more children with other ladies who liked him too. And even some members of the group that killed him were very fond of him. He was a terrific storyteller. I think this is mostly true. This is what I intuit, because there's so few hard facts. And very few hard facts, and almost everything that was ever written about Watson I discovered to be mistaken. I actually found the first photographs of Mr. Watson. I mean, I unearthed them. Even his own family hadn't seen them.
Where'd you find them?
I found them in the house of some cousins up in the woods in northern Florida, and that was that was kind of fascinating. But you see, what interested me, Charlie, was that the legends about this man are so numerous and mostly all wrong, but because of that, this myth has been forming, and even today, it's disputed down there. Did they shoot him because he raised his gun, or did they shoot him because they were planning to shoot him when he arrived in his boat that evening, October 1910? And this is still, depending on which side they were at the time, or the fathers or grandfathers were, then they take that position.
Well, clearly, knowing what you know, you take sides.
I do. And I take Mr. Watson right to the last moment when he either figures that he's miscalculated or he finishes out what he knows has to happen. And this is up to the reader. You have to decide that for yourself. He clarifies many of the points raised in the earlier books, but because I want this book to stand by itself, and I think it does, that you don't have to read the other two to read this one. So therefore, I want to leave it a little, I don't want to hammer it down, because there's the evidence of the other two books as well.
Right. In other words, you want the reader to decide exactly whether what was in Mr. Watson's head.
I want the reader to know Mr. Watson, not only know him, but know him so well that despite many terrible acts that he commits, I mean, he's not a good guy in many, many ways. If I've done my work properly, there'll be a sneaking sympathy for Mr. Watson in the reader. The reader will see the human correspondence between Mr. Watson and himself or herself. That's my task.
Well, you want the reader to find some connection between Mr. Watson and their own self,
I want the reader
choices.
To find the humanity in Mr. Watson, the common humanity they share. Mm-hmm. At one point in the other book, one of his wives says, she says about the people who are hostile to him, she says, you know, to one of the kids, she says, they're not afraid of Mr. Watson because he's a monster. They're afraid of him because he's a man. And just as I think, on Time magazine a few weeks ago, it showed the pictures of those two boys and the shooting in Colorado.
Yeah.
And it said, portrait of a monster or something like that. But there, the monster is used the same way I'm criticizing. We want to believe that those two boys are monsters because we don't recognize that they're partly us.
And it's too scary to realize that they're just like the kid down the street.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
You know, that there's a thin line between the somebody next door and those two kids.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It can go this way or that way. The human animal is very complex and doesn't take much to push those buttons.
How do you, I mean, you obviously have followed that story in Colorado.
I have
with interest.
But, you know, even one of the fathers involved said if Dylan, which is one of the boys, Dylan Klebold, I think, if he can do this, any child can do this, any kid can do this. He saw that this is the really horrifying part, not that those boys were sociopathic, but that they were, one of them at least, was so normal.
Dylan.
Yeah,
he seemed more normal than Eric.
Oh, yes, indeed. Yeah.
And Eric was clearly the leader, too.
Eric was just filled with rage, and rage can lead to terrible things, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, this is different kind of terrible things. I mean, rage can lead you to beat up somebody, or rage can lead you to...
But you can beat up somebody if you
walk in there and...
Yeah, but how about the Holocaust? An awful lot of people who were very calm throughout, a lot of bureaucrats cooperated in it. And not just a few, but thousands and thousands of people participated without any... How does that happen?
Does this interest you, this
very
subject
much.
Of what it is that drives people to irrational acts?
I'm interested in the nature of humankind. And you know, years ago I went on an expedition into the Stone Age in New Guinea, and we saw kids who were living in a culture which was really about 40,000 years old, the very beginning of modern man. And we saw kids in that culture. I really sincerely felt you could take those kids back with us to modern times and put them in school, and they do just fine. Their humor, their sharpness, their alertness. And these were kids who were surrounded by other tribes, Stone Age culture with stone tools, and they had never seen anything. They couldn't move because they'd be killed if they moved outside the circle. And yet, in many ways, they were more civilized than we were. So how can we say we've progressed? You know, we haven't.
Yeah, which brings me to things I want to talk about beyond this book. I mean, here is the story of, in Bone by Bone, of the continuation of the Watson story, the end of the trilogy. What drives you to go on all these trips? I mean, it's the Himalayas, it's the Everglades, it's one after the other.
In the beginning, it was really kind of cold financial considerations.
You were talking about when you were a commercial fisherman, or what?
Yeah. What happened was that I began as a fiction writer, and I still think of myself as a fiction writer, essentially. That's where I began. I wrote 3 novels, and I published about 10 short stories before I ever wrote nonfiction. But finally, I had a new marriage and 2 little kids, and I wasn't making a living, really. I first went to commercial fishing, and then I went to see Mr. Shaw of the New Yorker. And put my pitch was that, hey, you're doing all this stuff about the Western world and Europe and America, but how about these disappearing wildernesses? They're going down the tube fast. And how about sending somebody to the wild places? And this is the one thing I really knew how to write about. I knew about animals and birds. And I loved. Why did I know about them? Because I've been raised in Connecticut, or surrounded by my brother and I. Our hobby was snakes. We even had poisonous snakes in cages and everything, which we caught. And also I was fascinated by birds. I was a bird fanatic from the age of 8. And so I knew about that kind of stuff. I could write about boats and the outdoors and that kind of thing. And Mr. Shawn, to my amazement, agreed to this scheme. And so I went right off to South America, and that resulted in 2 books, The Cloud Forest, that was a nonfiction, and a book called At Play in the Fields of the Lord, which was a novel.
Yeah. But, see,
I would have... Pattern.
Yeah, set of patterns. And yeah. I mean, the editor of The New Yorker liked it, the readers of The New Yorker liked it, and you enjoyed doing it, I guess.
Well, it's
And
fun.
It provided some income.
Yeah. It made sense.
But did it enhance your desire to do that?
Well, I think
it... out there and be your own sort of... Indiana Jones?
Well, I think it did. I think in a way you get that habit. I just, you know, I was interested in certain things, and it's wonderful to have a curiosity about things someplace and have somebody pay you to go there.
Yeah, and also have the discipline of having to get it, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
You're not just sort of walking through, you know, oblivious to what's around you. You've got to write about it, you better be at your keenest observation.
And you have to do your homework before you go.
Exactly right. Yeah. You know, you got to know what you're there to see.
Otherwise you walk right past something that... You didn't know it was that.
If today you could go to one place, where would you go? Where do you most want to go? What experience do you most want to happen?
You know, it's very hard to say. I think I keep telling myself that I'm through with all this wandering. But I am going to Kamchatka in next spring, and then we're going to do a wonderful trip in India.
Yeah, but so is it the creative thing that drives you now? I mean, it's not the money. I mean, it's the creative thing, isn't it?
Well, it depends what you mean by creative. You see, nonfiction can be very creative. It can be, but it's very rare that it is because you're not. I mean, by definition, you're not supposed to be creative with nonfiction.
No, but you got to be creative in the way. You got to be skilled in the way you write it,
yes,
in the way you observe it, and you also got to be skilled at what you see. I mean, you know, you and I can look at this black cup, and you can describe this black cup much better than I can, probably, maybe not.
Not much better.
You could see more, and you see the black and the metal and the ceramic, and you see the wood, and you see that's observation. But you know, you're a skilled craftsman at that.
Well, yeah, but it's hard. You know, I wrote a book about the New Guinea thing under the mountain wall, and I remember Truman Capote said that he used that as a kind of a. It was one of the seminal influences toward the idea of the nonfiction novel.
Yeah, In Cold Blood.
In Cold Blood. Yeah, because we were in the Stone Age, and I was describing it, but we stepped back, and I just took the expedition out of it entirely. I just described it from the point of view of the people, and just their life going on morning after morning for thousands of years. And it was an experiment in a way, and in that sense, it was creative.
Somehow, it's a higher stage to write fiction for you. In other words, if Peter Matheson could have had his choice at some before he went to write this and fell in love with it, he still would have preferred to have written the great American novel than any piece of nonfiction you can possibly write.
There's a deeper truth in fiction. You see, you can get at a deeper truth. If you're stuck with the facts, there's only so far you can go, and then you're stretching your responsibilities as a writer. And whereas in fiction, you can go anywhere you want. And also, you never know where you're going. So it's very energizing. It's thrilling to see what comes through. You know, I don't know. Yes, I've always preferred it. I never had any interest in writing nonfiction. But now I see that my nonfiction and my fiction, in a way, are doing the same thing. I mean, they're working toward the same vision of life and what's happened to it.
Taking a note of all the things you've done and all that you have written, listen to this. I just want to read by Peter Matheson, Fiction, Race, Rock, Partisans, and Raditzer as at Play in the Fields of the Lord, for Tortuga on the River Styx, and Other Stories, Killing Mr. Watson, Lost Man's River, Nonfiction, Wildlife in America, The Cloud Forest, Under the Mountain Wall, Salsipuedes. The Wind, Birds, Blue Meridian, the tree where a man was born, the one that everybody knows, I bet, the Snow Leopard. Mm-hmm. Probably the most famous, wouldn't you think?
Yeah.
Sand Rivers, In the Spirit of Crazy Horse, Indian Country, Nine-Headed Dragon River, Men's Lives, African Silences, East of Low
Montagne.
Yeah. That's a rather heady body of work, we'll agree.
I know, it makes me feel old just to have you read it.
So, therefore, is there one great dream that lives in your soul even today?
About my work?
Yeah.
No, just that it be, yes, I guess so. I could say that, you see, I have this crazy confidence. If I didn't, I wouldn't have worked 20 years
exactly.
on this trilogy, you know.
Exactly.
But I think that my feeling is that at Play in the Fields of the Lord and Far Tortuga and this trilogy, whatever I decide to call it when it's not a trilogy anymore, I think it stands up pretty well with fiction that's being written these days. I'll put those up against
anything you see.
Well, not anything. I mean, I can, you know, there's some wonderful books out there. There's so many great, great books. And so I don't want to be, you know, arrogant about that. But I have a lot of confidence in it. I think that this trilogy stands for a tremendous amount in our country and in our history. It kind of reverberates from that. You could almost see that. Say that Edgar Watson was Uncle Sam.
Well, but did you have to find the story of Edgar Watson to write this?
Edgar Watson was in a sense the metaphor that pulled all of my ideas about traditional people. I've always been interested in American Indians and wildlife and environment and the glades. And he was the thing that drew it all together. He was the kind of the armature for the
whole. How'd you find the story?
I was going up the west coast of Florida in a boat with my father when I was about 17, and he showed me on the marine chart. He said, this is Chatham River, and this is Shark River. And way up Chatham River, about 3 or 4 miles, he said, there's a house up there. I said, the house? And it was the only house in the Everglades. And that stuck in my brain. Then he said, I think the guy was a bad guy, and he was killed by his neighbors. You know, and your neighbors aren't somebody on a crime turf area or something like that, and your neighbors kill you, and they're fishermen and farmers. What's going on? This is very, very... Yeah. So I was haunted by that. And then as I looked into it, he's supposed to have been the man who killed Belle Starr, the outlaw woman. It became a big, you know...
That's something you had to put your teeth into.
You said it. Yeah.
Bone by Bone by Peter Matheson. A novel by the author of Lost Man's River. They take note here on the cover. You are terrific, and I thank you for coming.
Thank you, Charlie.
Pleasure
to be here again.
Thank you. Back in a moment. Stay with us.